Hello and welcome to the Semantic Cybersecurity Brief, our fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things cybersecurity. I'm Dick O'Brien and joining me today once again is Semantic Threat Researcher Bridget O'Gorman. In this week's podcast, we will be discussing the return of Emotet, some recent law enforcement takedowns, an interesting new technique used in a recent Bazaar Loader campaign, and how the FBI was hacked to send out fake email alerts. But first, let's talk about critical infrastructure, because Bridget, you recently worked on a white paper that we sent to our customers that was all about attacks on critical infrastructure a couple of months ago. And there's been several recent reports in the news about attacks on that sector in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, so since I did that white paper, I suppose I've been sort of keeping an eye on that area a bit more in general. And there have been a few separate reports of attacks on critical infrastructure in several different countries and regions over the last few weeks. So first example I have is in Australia, hackers were able to stay undetected on the systems of a water company, a water supplier there for 9 months. A report that came out from the Queensland Audit Office this week, revealed, or last week. And the impact supplier in this case was called Sunwater. And this is an Australian government-owned water supplier that's based in the state of Queensland, that is responsible for operating 19 major dams, 80 pumping stations, and 1,600 miles of pipelines. So a significant amount of infrastructure there. And this breach occurred between August 2020 and May 2021. So carried on for 9 months, and the actors gained access to a web server that was used by the company to store customer information. Now, fortunately enough for the water supplier, it appears the hackers weren't overly interested in exfiltrating data or in causing disruption. Rather, the only thing they seemed to do was plant a custom malware on the server that would increase visitor traffic to an online video platform. So this would kind of indicate they maybe weren't particularly, you know, skilled hackers or that kind of thing. However, the fact that the hackers were able to gain and maintain access to the server without being discovered for 9 months is obviously quite alarming. And really, the water supplier is probably, you know, fortunate that they, you know, weren't compromised by an actor who may have been interested in disruption or sabotage of their operations, you know, which is something we've seen happen to critical infrastructure organizations over the last, you know, year or two, you know, especially given, I suppose, the large number of, you know, services operated by them, like pumping stations and dams, it could have potentially been quite serious. And the report said that the malicious actors, however, they did compromise, it was an older and a more vulnerable version of the system, and the modern and more secure web servers that they had were untouched. And they did also say the vulnerability that was used by the attackers has been fixed now, so it does seem it has been secured somewhat now.
And this report, it also highlighted something of a lack of proper security practices as well, didn't it?
Yeah, so this report also did reveal that Sunwater had, you know, several user accounts that had access to multiple systems, which obviously increased the risk in the case of, you know, a single point of failure, as we would call it. And also it's obviously a practice that kind of goes against the sort of minimum access, best practice type of, you know, I suppose, approach that all organisations should be following really. And the Queensland Audit Office also actually examined the internal controls of six water authorities in Australia. And they found deficiencies in three, and though they didn't name them specifically what those authorities were, but among the deficiencies was the absence of kind of anti-fraud safeguards that would, you know, help secure financial transactions from BEC actors, business email compromise actors, for example, as well as the presence of numerous vulnerabilities in IT systems, and then the absence of, you know, some pretty basic security practices, like even password kind of protocols and that sort of thing in some instances, which obviously, you know, in this kind of sector really isn't great.
Okay, well, that's Australia, but you said there was several more stories about critical infrastructure being compromised as well.
Yeah, so Palo Alto also published a report earlier this month about a ongoing state-backed hacking campaign that they said has led to the compromise of at least 9 critical national infrastructure organizations worldwide, with the sectors affected including defense, and healthcare, energy, technology, and education. So all pretty high-profile sectors there. And the attackers in this campaign outlined by Palo Alto exploited a known critical remote code execution vulnerability in Zoho's enterprise password management solution, which is known as Manage Engine AD Self-Service Plus. And the vulnerability is CVE-2021-40539. And they use this to gain initial access to victim networks, with researchers saying that this attack campaign actually began on the 17th of September, which was 9 days after the US Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency actually issued a warning about attackers exploiting this particular vulnerability in the wild. And while the attackers in this, once they gained initial access to victim networks, the attackers deployed a malware dropper that delivers what are called known as Godzilla web shells to compromise servers, as well as malware, including an open source backdoor called NGLite and the KDC Sponge credential stealer, with the malicious actors reportedly interested in stealing credentials, maintaining access, gathering sensitive files from victim networks for exfiltration. So all kind of pretty typical stuff there. And attribution was still ongoing in this campaign, Palo Alto said, but it said it did see similarities between this campaign and previous activity by the Chinese state-sponsored group, APT27, who are also known as a mystery panda. So it partially attributed this campaign to them based on the malicious tools and tactics that were used and previous APT27 activity, as well as the sectors that were targeted as being their kind of typical targets.
And there was even more attacks against critical infrastructure too, wasn't there?
Yeah, it was also reported by research from Accenture and Prevaeon that Iranian state-backed APT group Lycium was targeting ISPs and telecommunications service providers in the Middle East and Africa in a cyber espionage campaign. And in this case, backdoors were downloaded onto victim networks between May and October 2021. And in at least two of the identified victims, the compromises are believed to be still ongoing, according to this report. So it's quite recent, quite current activity. And organizations including in countries including Israel, Morocco, Tunisia, and Saudi Arabia were targeted, as well as the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in an African country as well. And Lycium used two distinct malware families in these attacks, which are known as Shark and Milan. And Shark basically generates a configuration file for DNS tunneling, or CNC communications, basically. And then Milan is used to retrieve data, and both of these backdoors then can communicate with the group's CNC servers. And the researchers also identified what they said was a reconfigured or potentially a new Lycium backdoor on one victim in late October, which they said indicates that Lycium is probably updating its backdoors due to recent public research into its activities. You know, when I was trying to stay ahead of the set of defensive systems, which is something we often see. Like, we often see variants, obviously, of malware once, I suppose, attackers are kind of exposed because they obviously want to update their methods, I suppose. So it's a lot of activity really being targeted at critical infrastructure organizations recently, you know, which obviously is very concerning given the type of organizations that, you know, come under this sector and the disruption, you know, that can be caused if they become infected by kind of sophisticated actors or subject to ransomware attacks or anything like that. But moving off the subject of critical infrastructure and onto you, Dick, you said you wanted to talk about the reappearance of Emotet, something we discussed a lot on this podcast in the past.
Yes, indeed. And I guess this could be one of the more significant cybercrime developments in recent months. So Emotet was, until very recently, one of the biggest players on the cybercrime scene until it was taken down. But now it appears to be back in part, at least. So let's delve into the background first, because I think this one maybe deserves a bit of context. Emotet was or is a botnet controlled by a cybercrime actor that we call Mealybug. They've been around since 2014, which is pretty much an eternity in cybercrime terms. And anyway, Emotet was, like a lot of botnets, set up initially as an instrument of financial fraud. So its main purpose was to act as a banking Trojan. And that meant that if somebody opened up an online banking session on an infected computer, it would attempt to steal their credentials and send them back to the attackers. Emotet had a number of things going for it as a threat. Number one, it had a self-propagation mechanism where it could infect other computers on a network by brute forcing passwords. And then secondly, and probably even more importantly, it had a spamming module. And that meant that the entire Emotet botnet could be leveraged to send out these big, massive spam campaigns which could infect even more computers with Emotet. And the upshot of all of this was that Emotet was very, very pervasive. And eventually, Mealybug, Emotet's operators realized that they could profit from this by selling access to the botnet to other threat actors, who could leverage their incredible reach to deliver their own malware. And this was so successful that the original financial fraud motive seems to have kind of gone by the wayside, more or less. And at this stage, lots of other botnets are following this business model. But I think Emotet was one of the first, if not the first, to kind of make that shift. So all of this meant that over the past couple of years, Emotet was a serious nuisance. It wasn't only a threat in itself, but it was implicated in a ton of other cybercrime threats. And not surprisingly, from a law enforcement perspective, there was a great big target on their back after a while.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was so pervasive there for a long time. But what happened to them then?
Well, finally, in January of this year, the law caught up with them, because there was a major international law enforcement operation involving police forces from lots of different countries that involved the seizure of a whole load of infrastructure and the arrest of two suspects in Ukraine. And then that was then followed up by a kind of a cleanup operation of sorts, where a few European police forces managed to basically delete all known existing Emotet infections. And the reason they were able to do this was because of that seized infrastructure. And they just sent out a new Emotet module out to the botnet, and it basically automatically uninstalled the malware. And with that, pretty much all trace of Emotet had kind of gone, at least we thought it had.
Yeah, now they're back. So what's happened?
Yeah, it would appear they're back. So according to a report in Bleeping Computer this week, this researchers from a bunch of different companies have noticed that Emotet is once again being distributed, although there's a bit of a twist this time, because Emotet is being distributed by TrickBot. And that's kind of the reverse of what used to happen, because Emotet itself was originally used to spread TrickBot around a lot. So what's going on here? Well, I guess it looks like there's some degree of collaboration between what's left of Mealybug or whoever owns that Emotet code now, and between them and the minor group who control TrickBot. Now, whether that's a permanent development or whether it's just a kind of a short-term thing, it remains to be seen. I guess either way, whoever is now in charge or left in charge of Emotet, if they want to kind of get back to where it was or near where it was, they're going to need some sort of help like this to build up enough of their own infrastructure to begin those great big spamming operations all over again. The malware itself also appears to have gotten a bit of work. Apparently the loader has been updated since it was last seen earlier this year. It's one to watch. It's not certain yet exactly what's going on, but if they do stage a successful comeback, it means that there's, I guess, yet another avenue of attack for threat groups, particularly ransomware groups at the moment, to get into people's networks.
Yeah, which isn't great, really. And you mentioned TrickBot there, and I think there was also something else related to TrickBot that you wanted to talk about today as well.
Yeah, there was. And it's probably more to do with a more kind of closely associated threat called Bazaar Loader. And as regular listeners to the podcast will know, they're both TrickBot and Bazaar Loader are linked to the aforementioned miner group, which some of the vendors called Wizard Spider. Anyway, what happened is that a Microsoft Windows 10 feature is currently being abused in a new phishing campaign involving Bazaar Loader. So the campaign was discovered by Sophos because some of its own employees were being targeted by it, by this phishing campaign. The emails purported to come from a Sophos manager called Adam Williams, who is a he doesn't exist. He's a made-up person. And the emails were They purported to be a complaint from Adam Williams about why the recipient hadn't responded to a customer complaint. And it's the kind of thing that I guess that would grab any employee's attention. But the emails, they had a link to a PDF. And if you clicked on the link, it invoked a tool that's used by the Windows Store application called App Installer. AppInstaller.exe. To download and run what the link points to. And in this case, it pointed to a text file named adobe.appinstaller, which then pointed to a larger file hosted on a different URL. And the user was then shown a warning prompt and a notice that the software has been digitally signed with a certificate issued a few months ago. And they're then asked to allow installation of something purported calling itself Adobe PDF component. And if they say yes, a Bazaar loader is installed. So I thought this was interesting for two reasons. Number one, it's kind of a technique I certainly hadn't seen before. And number two, it looks like they were specifically targeting security researchers, which is not something that I've seen this group do before either.
Yeah, that is interesting, all right, especially because we did see some security researchers targeted this year maybe. Not so sense of time, but targeted with the by the Lazarus group. So it looks like they're becoming a bit of a target for more malicious actors.
Yeah, it seems kind of super targeted for people like this. But it's interesting to see what if we find out what they're trying to do.
Yes, definitely.
Anyway, we were talking about the Emotet takedown earlier on this year, but there's been some more law enforcement activity in recent weeks that you've been reading up on, Bridget.
Yeah, so the US Department of Justice announced last week that it had charged a Ukrainian national for their role in the Kaseya ransomware attack, which occurred in July and which led to the Rebel or Southern Akibi ransomware being deployed on as many as 1,500 organizations after Kaseya, which is a managed service provider, basically was compromised. So 22-year-old Yaroslav Basiniski was arrested in Poland on the 8th of October, the DOJ revealed, and is currently awaiting extradition to the US, which is what this indictment that was unsealed last week revealed. And as well as the Kaseya attack, Basiniski also faces additional charges related to numerous other ransomware attacks. And the Department of Justice said as well that it also seized more than $6 million in ransom payments that were allegedly received by another rebel operator, a Russian national named Yevgeny Polanin, excuse my pronunciation, who unfortunately remains at large. And this announcement actually came around the same time as Europol revealed that Basiniski was among seven affiliates who had worked with the Rebel and Gangprab ransomware gangs who have actually been arrested since February this year. So three Rebel and Gangprab affiliates have been arrested in South Korea. Two Rebel affiliates have been arrested in Romania. A Gangprab affiliate was detained in Kuwait. And then obviously Basiniski was arrested in Poland. And Europol said that these seven suspects are believed to be responsible for ransomware attacks on as many as 7,000 victims that resulted in ransom demands of more than $231 million. So, you know, a significant amount of, obviously, you know, malicious activity there. And in the same week, then, the Department of State in the US also announced that it was offering a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the identification or location of any individual holding a key leadership position in the rebel gang, and $5 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of affiliates working with the gang. And this actually was very similar to an announcement made just days earlier, when the US government said it was offering a $10 million reward for information leading to the identification of members of the Dark Side ransomware gang, which of course is the gang behind the Colonial Pipeline attack that occurred in May this year, and which has also been operating under the Black Matter ransomware banner. And a $5 million reward was also offered for any information leading to the identification of any of their affiliates as well. So these developments are quite interesting, and it really just show that, you know, the US Department of Justice and law enforcement, I suppose generally globally, are really taking the threat of ransomware gangs very seriously at the moment.
Yeah, and some success there. You know, there's a not insignificant number of arrests there directed at Greville, you know. So they seem to be making progress.
Yeah, hopefully. We'll have to see if it makes any difference, I guess. And finally, Dick, you also mentioned something about the FBI system actually itself being hacked to send out fake emails.
It was a bit of an oops moment. So an email system belonging to the FBI was hacked last week and used to send a fake information security alert to about 100,000 people. And the incident was first spotted by spam monitoring service SpamHaus, and they, you know, immediately said that the emails appeared to be fake, that they weren't real, but they did seem to come from infrastructure that was owned by the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. And the emails told the recipients that the FBI was aware of, quote, exfiltration of several of your virtualized clusters in a sophisticated chain attack. So definitely one that would kind of cause people to panic. So in a subsequent statement, the FBI said that, yes, it was aware of a software misconfiguration that temporarily allowed an actor to leverage its law enforcement enterprise portal to send out the fake emails. And I presume that has been quickly, correctly configured.
It's not going to happen again.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for listening. That's about all we have time for this week. If you've been enjoying our podcast, don't forget to subscribe to avoid missing out on all of our future episodes. And you can also follow us on Twitter at Threat Intel. If you'd like to read our latest research, check out our blog, which can be found at semantic-enterprise-blogs.security.com/blogs/threat-intelligence. We'll be back again in 2 weeks' time, but until then, thank you and goodbye.